television nerds. My name is Anthony Marco, and welcome to TV ABCs, where we have conversations about Canadian television before cameras, before cuts, before channels, and explore how the people behind your favorite shows are being creative. This week, Aaron Poole. Aaron broke out in his defining performance in Ed Gas Donnelly's This Beautiful City, a film for which he was also a producer. He played a recurring role on TMN's ZOS, Zone of Separation, and was featured in Adam McGoyan's Adoration. After filming the third act of the American indie hit Circumstance in Lebanon, Aaron teamed up with Ed Gas Donnelly and producer Lee Kim once again for the feature Small Town Murder Songs. Poole is an executive producer and one of the lead actors in The Conspiracy, a mockumentary thriller about secret societies. Additionally, he's been in Showcase's Crash and Burn, HBO Canada's Living in Your Car, the global series King, BBC America's Copper, and most recently on CBC's Strange Empire. He was also featured in Samuel L. Jackson's The Samaritan, Jason Priestley's Cass and Dylan, and most recently featured in John Cassar's film Forsaken, starring opposite Kiefer and Donald Sutherland. And now, my conversation with Aaron Poole. I would say that you probably had a unique experience. Well, I can't say it's too unique as a Canadian actor, but you've gone through an experience where a lot of other Canadian actors have gone through. Can you tell me what the roller coaster is like of having a show that in many ways has such acclaim, and then all of a sudden you find out one day that show doesn't exist anymore?
Yeah, it's been really fascinating. I mean, for me, I was in, I would say, a fortunate position in that I knew that my participation had finished. Well, that's a bit of a spoiler alert. I was done after the first season.
Sure.
So I was able to be objective about the drama involving the cancellation of Strange Empire.
Right.
To a certain extent, I was watching friends and colleagues go through it more than actually feeling it, because I'd already said goodbye.
But you also like to think that I always feel like what happens after always has the potential to make what's happened before even more meaningful. So even being a part of that show, if it goes on for two or three more years, everything that you've done, like I've always said, you know, as great a movie as the first Godfather movie was, it was made better by Godfather 2.
That's a great point. I agree. You know, and to a certain extent, and I mean, obviously, you also set yourself up to, I would say that Godfather's sequel is an exception to the rule. Usually, the sequels degrade what came before it. Obviously, though, the possibility was that season two would be even better. Yeah. And interestingly enough, some people at CBC didn't want to take that gamble. And the tone of outrage seemed more from concerned citizens than it did from rabid fans. And I found that to be an interesting experience to watch from the sidelines. Certainly, I received tons of letters. Ironically, a lot of the people, I think, assumed that I would be more upset than I was because they hadn't even watched the show. They were just outraged it had been canceled. Like, so nobody knew that I'd die.
How dare you cancel this critically acclaimed show that I haven't watched?
So I think that that's actually a really, I've got a lot of half-baked ideas about whether, it was the right thing for the CBC to do or not. I can certainly see it from the creator's perspective, and I could also see it from an executive's perspective, why they might move on. But the one thing that I can say is that it seems kind of typical that people would jump on a bandwagon of outrage when they haven't even seen the show. And certainly there were a lot of people that I've spoken to like that.
I think part of that might come from the fact that for years, I know when myself, Diane, and Greg get together, we talk about the fact that we want the CBC to be a little bit more risky and to be a little bit more quote-unquote niche and delve into things that are a bit more daring. And this was a show that seemed a bit more daring. And so a lot of people, even though admittedly you're right, maybe the numbers weren't there in the end, but a lot of people applauded the fact that the CBC gave the show a shot to begin with.
It's very important for that reason. I agree. Yeah. And ultimately it's important that a show like that continue for the same reason. Yeah.
That was one of those things though, where I think a lot of people saw, this is the type of show we want to see, even though we might not be the ones watching it right now.
Yeah. And you know what? That's, and it's complete. It is fair. I mean, it certainly, I mean, I speak about things I know nothing about, you know, quite a, with authority a lot of the times, you know. It's just weird to be on the receiving end of that. And I mean, I can only imagine what it's like to work for years to create a world and to populate the world and then to have it suddenly ended. You know, by some network apocalypse.
Well, and wondering what the threshold would have been. Like, if we would have had 50,000 more viewers, 100,000 more viewers, would that have made the difference? Or was, you know,
I honestly, I mean, there's a little clip right now on the CBC site of Sally Caddo saying, you know, that it had nothing to do with numbers. And I think it probably didn't really have much to do with numbers. I had heard literally 3 days before the rumor broke by John Doyle, I think, on Twitter, that it had been canceled. 3 days before, I had heard that it was going to get renewed.
Wow.
That, you know, it was a soft renewal, but that was the rumor in the building. And so the fact that it was being considered as a confirmed renewal by, you know, pretty good sources shows me that they were considering it despite the fact that so few people were watching it. Right. So obviously if it had, you know, a million viewers a week, it would have everything to do with how many people were watching it. Right. But the fact that they were considering it right up to the end with so few people checking it out, I think it shows that it had to do with something else. And I don't know what that is. I don't want to speculate on that.
Sure.
I have no,
for sure.
Yeah.
So now whenever I'm talking to somebody, I always go to the two sources of all knowledge on such things, Wikipedia and IMDb, which can both be wildly inaccurate. But let me hope that at least part of this is right. It says here that you're originally from Barrie, Ontario.
Mostly right. Yeah.
There's a town, Innisfil?
Yeah. Craighurst.
Okay.
Close. Yeah. Up around Horseshoe Valley.
Okay.
There's a town of, I think probably 150 people now, that is at a crossroads just off the 400.
Okay. So were you, kind of immersing yourself in acting as far back as school? Is that where it kind of bit you the first time?
Yeah, I growing up, my parents brought my sister and I to a lot of dance, oddly enough. You know, they were a part of that sort of hippie group of people that moved out of the city and into the country and right. bought up old homes. And so we would take trips into Barrie and Toronto to see dance. And my sister became a dancer, and I guess I didn't realize it, but it was contributing to a love of performance, live performance. And yeah, it was in high school in grade 10, I think, that I did, actually, no, it was earlier, 7 and 8, that I did school plays. Right. So I guess I liked it from then, but I didn't know I was going to do it, you know?
I think a lot of people have a very interesting relationship with dance as a performance vehicle, because it's literally one of the, and I'll admit I haven't gone to see a lot of dance performances in my life, but it's one of the few things where you can be seriously almost moved to tears just by movement.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, I won't go on too long about it, but certainly, I mean, my love for abstraction in story came, I think, from an early exposure to dance. I mean, there is nothing literal, and I'm not talking about ballet. I mean, although I was made to watch a lot of ballet, I don't actually like classical storytelling in ballet,
right.
Because it's too literal. I love that kind of abstract approach to story images,
right.
And because it allows, I think, the audience to really project. Through the lack of detail, it allows you to project what you need out of the story into the experience. And for that reason, you know, gesture can move you to tears, I think, because it ends up being so personal.
It's one of those few art forms that the equivalent of reader response theory is so important. It's so much of what you bring to that experience.
I completely agree. Yeah. And it's interesting that has sort of ended up being, I love abstract film. I love performance art for the same reason, sort of, you know, subgenres that require a bit more narrative, but are still really odd for the audience to experience.
Does that, when you decide that you're going to take on a role and take on a character, do you start to, and I would think more for either when you get into a series or when you get into a film, something that's more longer form than maybe a single episode, do you start to think because of that experience about movement as a vital part, as opposed to just hoping that it kind of works out?
You mean my approach to character?
Yeah, like how the character moves and how you believe that it might be perceived, like, because it's not a stage, you're dealing with a screen often. And so can you think that deeply into it? Or does it just become self-defeating because you know that you're going to be subject to the whim of whatever editor comes upon it?
I mean, that's an interplay. Definitely. Those doubts enter the process at every point, but without prediction. Right. But definitely my approach, includes, wondering about the physicality of the character. I don't think everyone does that, but there are a lot of people, especially sort of the people that approach it from like classical training. Like outside in versus inside out, I would say is determined by the demands of the role, but I almost always think about physicality. It's important to me for sure. Yeah. And then, you know, you are always subject to what happens in the editing room. And what I loved about doing this series, Strange Empire being my first lead in a series, was the control that I felt I had over the arc. Right. You know, there was definitely a great interplay between what I was contributing to the character and from what Laurie was giving me as a writer. And so there was I felt a little bit more control as it related to how characterization affected story.
And was probably a result of the creative team also being able to probably glom onto or read what you wanted them to read when they first saw that character from you and say, this is going to work with what he's trying to do here.
Definitely. I've described it before as almost like a choose your own adventure where we are co-creating the twists and turns. You know, they definitely had everything plotted out, but they would allow the journey to be affected by how I had done one episode, and they would incorporate that into the next episode. It was really a fantastic sort of long form acting experience that almost trumped from purely a performance perspective the experience I've had in any feature film.
Now, I'm curious, as we're seeing television move more towards these kind of serialized stories, I mean, you've been now going through enough years and enough series where you've probably played your share of procedurals and your share of serials. Do you have a preference at this point, or is like, do you feel like you can kind of sink your teeth into the serialized shows a bit more? I've never
Definitely.
Really, yeah. Has it come down to that? Because I know that there's certainly enough challenges and enough ways that you can be creatively satisfied, I'm sure, doing a procedural story, but there's mm-hmm. something that's nice about a long story arc.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think just from the perspective, the kind of acting I like to do, that serialized story is something that I can just lose myself in the mystery of. You know, even though I'm helping create the mystery for the audience, it's really something that sense of not knowing is a very satisfying thing to engage for me. So serialized story definitely has been something I prefer to procedural. And it's not like I'm at the point where I'm choosing, you know, among sort of like 10 different series that I want to do, but I've been lucky enough that I can either work in independent film or, you know, lately serialized story.
Right. So, and that's another thing I'm noticing too, is I'm kind of glancing over the CV, so to speak, and seeing not only a lot of television, but a lot of television movies and a lot of other films. It seems like you found a pretty interesting balance. I mean, a lot of times when I'm talking to actors for this podcast, I see, you know, a lot of different TV series interspersed with a couple films here and there. it seems like you've worked a pretty good balance with regards to film and television. Is it that you prefer one, or that you just prefer to keep it that diverse to keep yourself kind of on the ball, so to speak?
It hasn't really been, in my control a whole lot. In the beginning, I just wasn't, like, fresh out of theater school, I wasn't getting hired. I find myself in rooms with a lot of sort of model-y looking guys and people with, like, a good talent and lots of good looks were usually getting the roles. And I got really discouraged. And I just, so I would do a little bit of independent theater. And I would say that my ties with theater and my dissatisfaction with, the state of my TV film career pushed me into creating my own film work. Right. And I was lucky enough that it just coincided with the technological revolution, the digital stuff. When I first graduated from theater school, maybe it was high school, the Canon XL1 camera was that first prosumer camera that sort of went through the industry like wildfire, and people were actually making feature films right. for the first time and short films for very little money. And so it became a lot more possible to make your own movie. And so over sort of those next 6-7 years, I became, I guess, a little bit more in charge of the kind of thing that I could do with my time. Instead of lining up and waiting for auditions, we would get together and make our own movies. And so that, I would say, is responsible for the larger number of film opportunities that I've had. You know, and the more film that you're in and the more control that you've exerted over your own career, the more people start to take you seriously and then ironically hire you for those jobs you weren't right. getting before.
do you start to see yourself at this point as, maybe not see yourself is the right word, but is there a certain creative, any different level of creative satisfaction that you take away from being writer, director, producer, creator of a film versus sinking your teeth into a part? Or is it just a matter of, whatever I'm doing, I'm going to invest whatever I can into that to achieve the creative satisfaction out of that? Or is there stuff that you happen to like more in your skill set that you like exercising your chops, so to speak?
It's a good question. I think that, acting is still the juice for me. I mean, that's, I think I just love people and I love pretending I'm somebody else. And I just love the way that takes me into the world. Mm-hmm. But also team building. So as a producer, once I've developed a script with a writer director to a certain point, and we can start to invite people to collaborate on it. That's something that I just absolutely love. I love the idea of community. I love the problems that come up yeah. when you get any group of human beings together. And I love solving those problems. So I would say that producing and managing people is a great accompaniment to my acting, but that acting still trumps all the experiences.
So you also mentioned that you did some theater work. Do you still regularly do theater work, or is it kind of fallen by the wayside as the works come up more and more?
Mostly it's fallen by the wayside. A really good friend of mine runs a company out of Toronto called The Company Theatre. It's quite successful.
Okay.
That's Philip Riccio and Alan Hocco are the co-artistic directors. Hocco, as sure. Jake Doyle, right? Yep. So they run this theater company, and I've had the opportunity to work with them in the past, and invitations have come up, but it's really a time and money thing. I'm at a point where I'm sort of expanding who I can collaborate with in other countries, and that has required a lot of my time. I mean, I'm in California right now, and unfortunately, being here and meeting new people sometimes takes up the time that I would normally use, developing new ideas or being in a stage play.
Right. It's funny because a few of the actors I've talked to have also done stage. To a person, now it could just be the subset of actors that I'm talking to, will tell me that they love television now more than they love theater because they find if they achieve a certain perfection in a take, they like the fact that they will never have to do it again and perhaps not achieve that perfection. In other words, if I did it right one time, why do I have to do it again?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's so funny. I mean, I definitely agree. There's almost nothing I love more than acting, than being finished acting.
Right.
Like when as soon as I'm done, that sense of relief. You know, it's like coming down the mountain. So it is. I love setting myself up for the challenge, but that feeling of accomplishment is great. And there is something about TV and film that allows you to just seek perfection and then be done with it. But that ego rush of having a record of it, I think, is a part of it. I think the stage actor loves the immediate response of the audience. A lot of people speak about that, but I find that part embarrassing. I like having a record of it, and I want people to either love it or hate it, but away from me. They can watch it and feel how they feel about it without me being there. When I was doing stage work, coming out afterwards was among the most embarrassing experiences I can think of.
The curtain call, you know, so to speak.
Yeah, the curtain call, and then you know, family, friends, colleagues, strangers, right. You know, at the stage door, as many as there would be, was just something that,
because no matter what they thought, nobody is going to come up to you and say, oh, yeah, well, that was okay.
Oh God, no! What you get is the like strained smile. Congratulations, yeah. Congratulations! Oh, you must be so happy. You know, that kind of thing. But I can't deal with that.
It's kind of like when you've had a child and it's like, good for you, congratulations. That's good for you. You get ready for the crying now.
Oh man, yeah. So no, I think that speaks to a certain amount of privacy that I like with the process. I love that in TV and film, once you've reached a certain point, people really don't try to pretend that they know the character better than you. They leave you alone. They trust you as the expert. And then your process is private. You know, you're working with the director and the writer and your other actors, but you are the boss for that character. In theater, everyone is an aficionado on the character, and you know, while there's always things to be learned from other people, I just could never stand the public contribution to a process that I wish to be private, to remain private.
Right. It's different than I've been a musician my entire life, and you want to feed off that crowd vibe. But oftentimes, there's not many theater experiences where the crowd's encouraged to start to whoop it up and, you know, start nodding their heads and get into it. I mean, that's a music thing. That's not a theater thing. If they did that in theater, they get shushed.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that level of propriety. Yeah, it's wild.
When you start talking about privacy, I've actually never had the opportunity to ask this of someone before, but when you're on a film or television set, how often do you get to that point where you would hope you could get to this point often where you can actually just, where you can totally lose yourself and like really to the point where, you know, when cut is yelled, like it's almost like you're waking up. Can you achieve that on a regular basis or with all the lights and the crew? Does it really take some time to get there? Or is it just a matter of you hope that there's a long enough scene that allows you to get there as opposed to some kind of 5-second shot?
That's interesting. I think to a certain extent that, you know, what you just described has been like romanticized and mythologized.
Sure.
You know, in our culture of you know, being fascinated with storytelling, and I think that, I mean, those are special moments, and it's not something that I've experienced regularly. And I can't attribute you know, the fact that I've experienced them to any one thing, whether it be the length or the quality of the scene. It just sometimes it happens or it doesn't.
It would just have it almost has to be near impossible from my perspective to shut out all that sensory information.
Yeah, I mean, the trick though, and I mean, what I really love about working on a crowded set is to balance the expectations I have of myself for the content of the scene with that kind of din and that, you know, being watched and observed so carefully, really trying to perform at a peak level, even with all those seeming distractions. And I think in that way, it's a lot like, you know, doing sort of performing sports at a high level. You know, when you're in the Olympics, anything that I've read about performance psychology, you know, the athletes are working days ahead of the big qualifier and the big competition to stay in a zone where, you know, the diet and how they relate to their family and friends and themselves with sleep pattern and such is all being designed to stay focused. And in that, performance psychology has been something that has really fascinated me and something that I try to maintain when I'm in an important project, so that, you know, I'm just not one of those guys that can kind of like be completely available to social hour just before a take,
right,
and then to be right back into it. Like, I think there's a lot of sort of urban myths, and actually they may be truths, about like Anthony Hopkins, you know,
yeah,
who's just like able to handle anything and then be bang, like right back in it. I find I have to sort of keep a certain amount of my focus so that I can set myself up for those times of complete immersion, which don't always happen, but when they do, it's pretty cool.
Are there any like tricks or techniques? Like, are you the guy who walks around with headphones listening to a certain type of music that will help you lock in on your character? Or is it
Interestingly, yeah, over the years, music has been something with the iPod that has really been helpful, but I don't always use it. It depends on the character. It depends on what the scene is. It depends on my relationship with the crew. You know, some crews can see that I love to be friendly and respectful, but that for me to be at my best, there's not a lot of poking that can happen just before.
Right.
And so if some people can't discern that, I find just having my headphones in my ears creates like a bubble,
right,
you know, and it's like, oh, you know, he's focusing, that kind of thing. So it's like a little way to say like the doctor is not in.
Right. Now I didn't warn you about this. I often warn people beforehand, but we always on this podcast do a beverage update.
Oh,
so
okay.
You don't have to have a beverage with you, but you can talk about a beverage that you might like to have. I'll kick things. And the reason we do this, quite honestly, is on the regular TVA podcast, myself, Diane, and Greg, every week we talk about what we're drinking, because sometimes it gives us license to tear things apart if we get particularly angry at things.
I love it.
Diane usually wins, by the way, because she usually has four different beverages in front of her at any given time, whereas I'm usually the most boring. But today, in honor of our discussion, I've cracked out one of my bourbons. I have a wall of bourbon. I absolutely love it. And so I'm enjoying a sip of Russell's Reserve Small Batch Single Barrel, which is
Russell's Reserve.
Yes.
Where's that from?
It's a Wild Turkey product. So
cool.
It's kind of the high end, one of the higher end Wild Turkey products.
Yeah.
I actually did a drive through Kentucky last summer and stopped at a bunch of the distilleries. I like my bourbon.
Man.
So even if you don't have a drink with you, maybe give us a drink of choice, so to speak, a beverage of choice.
My go-to is an Irish whiskey usually. I mean, I'm drinking coffee and water right now from an old Brita filter, which I may end up getting wasted on, depending on what is collected in that thing.
Greg and I talked about last week the idea that it's like, if you can say, the charcoal was artisanally mined from...
You know, man, we are not that far off.
Yes.
We are not that far off. The place where I get my coffee from around the corner from the studio I'm renting has, it's like a juice place also.
Yes.
And from what I can tell, it's a brand of juice that has been moving through California. And I mean, you kind of get these like mini milk bottles and people are paying $10 for them. And one of them is a lemonade basically with charcoal in it. It's like and some kind of clay. So, I mean, apparently this is going to act upon my liver and help flush chemicals. But as far as I know, the only time people growing up, the only time anyone I knew ingested charcoal was when, you know, that poor brother had been hospitalized for overconsumption of booze. You know, so maybe this is like a hangover helper that I should get on board with. But yeah, so that there is artisanally created charcoal. But that's not my drink of choice. Usually my go-to is an Irish whiskey and something typical like Jameson. But Redbreast has been something I've dug. I'm not a big Scotch guy.
Same here. I'm not an Irish guy at all.
overpowering, man. Like I can appreciate all the sort of subtleties of flavor, but in that I find it too rich. When I've sat down, I feel like if I have an ounce of it, then I'm full and I'm done.
I had the opportunity to go in Toronto. They have a couple of the tasting liquor stores where you can go in and try. And so I tried Johnny Walker Blue because it's legendary, yep. right? And I came back and a couple of friends said, well, you know, what did it taste like? And I'm not a scotch drinker, so how do I describe it to them? So I just said, it tasted scotchy.
They must have been so pissed.
They were, exactly. It's like...
Johnny Walker Blue, what is that, an ounce in Ontario?
It's I don't know. But like the little whatever, like quarter ounce that they pour you, I think was like $5 or $6 or something like that.
Oh, I think that's cheap, because if you're buying, I mean,
but like that was just like it was a taste, like literally wasn't even a full shot or anything.
Right. They're just trying to recoup capital cost.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Because they want you to go buy a bottle of it. Bourbon. Yeah. I absolutely love. I got about 60 bourbons sitting behind me.
That is crazy. Yeah. So do you have a special room for it, or is it your kitchen?
Office? So I'm in my rec room right now. I call it the basement bunker. It's where I have everything set up, and I went to one of those. Kind of IKEA offshoots and bought these two glass cabinets that I had to build myself that I keep all of my bourbon in.
That is amazing. Aren't you afraid that it being a glass cabinet, are the shelves also glass? I would be worried that they would smash under the weight. Or I guess it makes you sort of required to keep them drained.
Well, yeah, it's not even that, but here's the nice thing about it is because I love... There's so much sensory that I love about bourbon. Like, I love the smell, but I also love the look, like the rich brown look of bourbon.
Color.
And so to have the light coming through the back of it and being able to see it is, to me, it's part of the experience. But I will say across the room from me, at one point I bought from a duty-free store, I've got a 4-liter bottle of Jameson's.
Oh.
It's on one of those swing stands.
Beautiful. That is beautiful.
And I was saying, because I believe the statute of limitations is passed on this. When I came over the border, they said, did you bring anything back with you? And I said, I got a bottle. It's like, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, they didn't realize that was why you had the U-Haul.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man, that's great. Yeah, I like the smoothness and the drinkability, because usually when I'm sitting down and enjoying a brown liquor, I have to admit, it's not in small quantity. I'm not a sipper.
Yeah.
And now, you know, over the years, you know, I've learned to sort of taper off.
Sure.
You know, and as I approach the end of the night, I don't kind of go hard until I go black. You know, it's usually in, you know, sort of considerable quantity. And I've just found that Irish whiskey is the best for that. It's smooth and flavorful. But Jameson is my go-to. Neat. Double shots. Crazily enough, as I said, I was in California. And when you order a double Jameson down here, you get a rocks glass full.
Wow.
Like, it regularly, that is what they'll serve you. I mean, these are not true ounces that I'm getting, which is just the generosity of Americans.
No, it's the ability to not have that much syntax on your alcohol, I think.
Think that's probably it, huh? Yeah, yeah. It's crazy. It's crazy.
I want to talk to you about the conspiracy.
Great.
You totally entered my wheelhouse with this. So as I was doing my crack research on this and I saw the conspiracy, it's like, I have to go check that out. And admittedly, like I said to you before we started recording, I still haven't watched the last 5 minutes of it. Because I've been kind of watching it all afternoon. I have to ask, because my favorite novel of all time is a conspiracy theory novel.
Oh, cool.
And it's Foucault's Pendulum by Umberto Eco.
I of course know of it, and I've never read it though.
It is, I think, after doing this film, it reminded me so much of a lot of aspects of it.
Really, cool.
because it's a story that's a bit humorous as well as being conspiracy theory. It's about a group of guys who work at a publishing company who, when they do research for this big compendium of conspiracy theories they're doing, decide to invent one. And it draws them into the entire world of it against their own will, basically.
Incredible. Yeah. Well, that was my experience making it.
Yeah, for sure. For people who haven't seen it, maybe give a bit of background to it, because to me, this has got to, I don't know how, I know that it showed at a couple of festivals,
Yeah.
Give me a bit of the history of this. I know it's a couple years old already, but I was intrigued.
Well, yeah, the plot concerns two filmmakers who choose to do a bio documentary of a conspiracy theorist who then disappears. They choose to investigate what he was looking into, and they go down the rabbit hole. Right. So it's a fake documentary. And it was meant to be an entertaining fake documentary with political elements. And we, Chris McBride is the writer-director, and he found the online conspiracy theory community as a fascinating thing and something which hadn't been exploited for a film story. And it has ended up being embraced by the horror community because the level of dread that a lot of people feel within the story kind of raises it to that kind of level. And it did really well for us. You know, we went to Fantastic Fest, which is this fantastic genre festival in Austin, Texas. And based on that, all of us, it was kind of opened some doors in Los Angeles. And Chris is now writing and directing three big budget features for different studios. Okay. But
that's the cops coming for you, by the way, because you're talking.
Yeah, that's okay. You can hear that. Yeah, it's Los Angeles. There's always. I'm sure you've been hearing what's going on. I'm actually living down right by Skid Row where there was that shooting last week with the police. So it's, you don't want the cops to come for you in this town.
Black helicopters, man. Black helicopters.
Oh, they're everywhere. Totally. So the film is made in such a way that a lot of people are uncertain about its truth. You know, we use my real name. Jim Gilbert, the other actor in the story, uses his real name. And though we're playing characters, the fact that our real names are used and that we're traceable online confuses a lot of people. We blend a lot of real historical events and known cabals with our fictionalized ones. And people are just confused by it. A lot of people, I don't want to ruin the end for you, but a lot of people send me surprised emails. Every single week I receive at least a new message on Facebook or some way from somebody who has felt that they've tracked me down. Chris McBride's real phone number, I'm sure he'll be real happy that I'm saying this yet again, is used in the film, and he gets texts and calls every week by people that think that they've found me, because in the film it's purported to be my phone number. It's incredible the reaction that it gets from people.
It's an incredible social experiment when you get that crossover, into real life with a story. Because as much as people like to look at it and say, "Yeah, that's narrative," I get that's narrative. But what if?
Yeah.
And the more you try and dissuade someone, the more going to believe it's true.
Oh, it's true, certainly in a lot of circumstances. And you know what's interesting, man? Like, I have a 13-year-old daughter, and she has been introducing me to YouTube stars.
Yeah. You're a lucky guy.
Okay. So we went to see Miranda Sings live.
Okay.
When she came down to visit me, and that was a fascinating experience in and of itself. But what I've learned is that generation, it doesn't want to know whether the person they're watching is a real person or not. And in many cases, I can tell as a story professional that these are hybridized versions of reality that are being shot on webcam and then published or broadcast weekly. And the fans don't care. They don't want to know whether it's real, whether it's not. There is this illusion that it is real, and that's a big part of the draw. They feel like they're getting this private and personal message from somebody that they admire. Yeah. And I think that really, that's been a part of the fascination of the conspiracy, because a lot of the people that are contacting me are in their early teens to early 20s, and that's kind of been how they've come up. They're of that web culture. Is that millennial? Is that a millennial? I don't know what the phrase refers to, millennial.
I'm not even sure anymore. All I know is I'm not one of them. I know that
yeah,
much.
Yeah, I know. Gen X. I'm purely Gen X, you know. But it's a fascinating thing as a story professional to watch the blending of reality and fiction and to have the audience surrender their ability to discern between the two.
Right.
They don't want to know. They just want to feel like they're getting a privileged experience, and I think partly that's why the conspiracy has done well.
Well, it seems like they're, like you said, with all of the narrative that's being told digitally now, it's one of those things where we've probably got a generation that's going to be, like you say, not only doesn't care, but is looking for that unique perspective of narrative to be told, which is a lot more personal. You know,
because
they're watching it on their own. They're not watching it on a big screen. They're not even watching it on a big screen TV. They're watching it on their phone, and they've got earbuds in, and there's that relationship that they have with that person.
Yeah, because, you know, you and I could be having this conversation using the same technology that a story can also be consumed. Yeah. And so I think it's you know, how the story is consumed is a big part of that reader response, you know, that feeling of intimacy. And it's something that we're just starting to get a handle on, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously that, you know, my daughter's generation already has a handle on it.
And sure.
I, you know, we sound like two old men, like coming late to the party, but it's fascinating from story structure and storytelling.
Well, it's something as a podcaster that I've considered for a lot of years, because to me, that's the key difference between podcasting and radio. Is podcasting is something that, you know, it's us two right now, and the people who are listening to this podcast are either in their car or they have earbuds in, and they're listening to us talk. They're making a choice as individuals to put earbuds in and listen to us have this conversation. It's not background noise for them.
No. No, there's a real intimacy to that. And it's interesting you just describing that. It makes me feel very present to that relationship. It's pretty special. Yeah, it isn't that.
Say hi to Jen, by the way. She's listening to me.
Hi, Jen.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm really glad you showed up.
We just freaked out about three people, probably.
I know. Jennifer. And there's also Jason.
Yes.
And Michael.
Yes.
Lisa.
It's like Romper Room. We're looking through the mirror at everybody. And it's like, I can see you, I can see you, and I can see you.
I know. It's amazing.
What kind of stuff did you grow up with? What were the big influences on you growing up? Because I know that I am a fixture of everything that I grew up with in my childhood, and the television that I watched, the movies that I watched, they still are so, they're these cultural touchstones to me today. Are there still things that you watch on a regular basis, or whenever you see it, that nostalgia comes creeping back in, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I didn't have a lot of TV or film growing up, so obviously I already talked about the influence of like live dance.
Yeah.
But the stuff that I did see are, you know, icons of our generation. Star Wars was something I was obsessed with.
Right.
And I mean, luckily so, because of the sort of mythological stuff that it drew from.
I mean, it was all Joseph Campbell, essentially, right?
Yeah. And before I knew of Joseph Campbell, I was obsessed with Greek mythology from sort of that like iconic exposure in Star Wars. So that was something I was really interested in. But then, you know, it was a lot of books. I loved obviously Tolkien, but I got into Clive Barker at an early age.
Right.
And so I think that sort of magic realism and dream logic was something that I became obsessed with, and has influenced the kind of film and TV that I really love.
You didn't stray into Lovecraft, did you?
Actually, only within the last 2 years. A lot of my friends are sort of comic book junkies and horror junkies now, and Lovecraft I came to really late. The Color from Outer Space, is that the name of that short story, that novella?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not a huge fan. I've read enough to know that that's almost like that next step, right?
It is.
Yeah.
No, it's amazing stuff, and I've come to enjoy the stuff that I've encountered of his. I'm picked up a book of short stories by George Saunders, who has a really interesting sort of grounded science fiction dystopian view of the future. Right. So that's definitely, in terms of the kind of stuff that I read, I Blade Runner and Philip K. Dick,
yeah.
Minority Report. I think they're shooting a series of the Minority Report now, which I'm really curious
And they've announced a sequel to Blade Runner now.
I know, with Villeneuve directing, or at least he's in talks to direct.
And with Harrison Ford coming back.
I know, dude. You know that he just crash landed his. Well, of course, yeah. He crash landed his plane.
Apparently, he couldn't make it to Sausalito in 12 parsecs.
Amazing! I just saw a photograph of the friggin' plane that he downed. Honestly, the whole thing feels like a publicity stunt because his son shows up and says he is as strong as you can imagine. This man, and he and some other dude crash landed a World War II plane in a golf course in Venice Beach. Like it's this yellow painted like two seater. Almost like a biplane, I don't know. It's what you can imagine a World War II bomber would look like. I mean, who is this guy? He's a superhero. I swear to God, I think it was a publicity stunt. This town is nuts for those things.
Han crashed first, I think, is what it comes down to. So are you able to give us an indication of why you're hanging out down in L.A. these days?
Well, really, it's just meeting new collaborators. I had been obsessed and focused on the Canadian industry through the indie films that we were making. So I had sort of projects that were ready to go and then would go, and the next one was ready to go, and so it would keep me up there. As well, my daughter has a thriving young teen life in Toronto, and so I felt like I needed to be there for that.
Sure.
But there's a little bit more freedom now.
Right.
And you know, because she doesn't want me around, being a 13-year-old girl. So
that sounds so depressing. I was gone for 2 weeks before she noticed I was gone.
Yeah, exactly. Where's dad? Oh, who cares? And really, it just coincided with the invitations from the conspiracy. So having finished the conspiracy, there were more doors open down here for me.
Right.
And being in between projects, this is a time when a lot of TV is being made. So it worked out really well. So I've been down here meeting all kinds of American television makers, mostly.
Very, very cool. Anything we should be watching for coming up that... I see that there's on the IMDb page, there's a couple of post-production notices.
Yeah, I did a film that has been in perpetual post with Kiefer Sutherland and Donald Sutherland, directed by John Cassar, and I think it's called Unforgiven.
Forsaken?
Oh, Forsaken. Thank you. Okay. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, yeah. Unforgiven. Jesus, that's the Eastwood, right?
Unforgiven 2.
Yeah.
The Unforgivening.
Unforgivener. it's called Forsaken, right? So it's changed its name a bunch of times, hence my confusion. So I think that should be coming out at some point. Who knows what's holding it up. And I finished a film with people who are involved with sort of their junior and associate producers at Orphan Black. Hannah Cheeseman is one of the principals, and we shot a film during the Miami sort of art fair that occurs every single year, and the Basel there. And so we shot a film a few months ago, which should be complete this year. But you know, nothing in particular. It should be interesting.
So getting the gears going and waiting for Conspiracy 2.
Exactly.
The conspirining. Thanks very much to Aaron Poole for talking television and film with me, talking a bit about his career, where he came from, all of that stuff. What an enjoyable conversation on my behalf, and hopefully you enjoyed it too. And if you have ideas for maybe some people you'd like us to talk to, who you'd like us to get, so to speak, feel free to fill in the comments underneath this episode at the tv-eh.com website. If you click on podcasts on the front page, you can find all of the podcasts there. You can support us by clicking on the Patreon button in the top right corner, And, you know, if you feel like this is worth, you know, a couple bucks to you a month, let us know. Support us there. We would certainly appreciate it. It helps us get the content out to you as quickly and efficiently as possible. Thank you to everybody, all of our past patrons who've contributed to the podcast over the past few weeks to a month. It's been awesome. You can follow the TVA website on Twitter by going to TV_EH. You can find all of the other podcasts that I do at anthonymarco.com. And you can find me on Twitter at Anthony Marco. Please feel free to get in touch. We take your criticism. We then get out a silver shovel and we bury it in the ground. And hopefully it grows into a lovely collaboration of communication between us and you, the home listener. And I think that wraps up another episode for this week. And now back to your regularly scheduled programming.